See you. Just wanted to find a little, what do you call it, a little verse to read to you. Okay, let me just get to where I have to be. Hold on a second. Most of our lives are mysteries, and our practice aids in the process of self-discovery, to know ourselves and to be known. Now, there isn't a direct word-for-word equivalent of the phrase "know thyself," which comes from ancient Greek philosophy, the Delphic oracle, later Socrates, etc. And of course, know thyself is usually, if you will, connected to self-reflection and moral awareness. In the Tanakh, in the Hebrew scriptures, and rabbinic thought, however, the core idea of introspection or self-knowledge and self-improvement is certainly present, but expressed differently. Simply put, our introspection, at least in our tradition, self-knowledge, is a manifestation of God, for it is only God who knows our innermost parts rather than ourselves. So our Torah this week harbors within it a mystery, a great mystery. And that mystery is found as we go into the Parsha of Shemini. And it's a few verses, and I'll just read the verses to you. And it's Leviticus 9 to Leviticus 11, and here how it goes. And now Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, each took the fire pan, put fire in it, and laid incense on it, and they offered before the Lord alien fire, or strange fire, which he had not enjoined upon them. And fire came forth from the Lord and consumed them. Thus they died in an instant of the Lord. Then Moses said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord meant when he said, 'Through those close to me, I show myself holy and gain glory before all the people.'" And Aaron was silent. You know, most of our interpretations of this event, a very horrific event, if you can imagine it. Now remember, the story happens right after the opening of the Mishkan, the opening day of the Mishkan, the inauguration of the Mishkan. They've worked so hard, they've been so meticulous. Or Parshiot and Parshiot, four separate Parshiot describe all the details, and people have come together and created this communal event, and now the opening day. And on the opening day, right after Aaron pushes the switch, if you will, the switch which is to start the process of installing God in God's dwelling place, the Mishkan, he puts onto the altar the offering, and sure enough, a fire comes down from heaven and consumes it, and thus everyone takes a sigh of relief, and they said, "Ah, the system works, the system works." because ultimately, for the system to work, we have to create the sense of a access, a tremendous access. And the system works because it works the same for everyone. So the real question is, how is it possible that someone out of his own volition offering up something would merit, if you will, annihilation? It's a very good question. The initial intention of the Mishkan and the intention of the temple later on was that it would be totally accessible, that it would be equitable, that it would be, quote unquote, owned by all the people, that the system would be consistent, lacking in whimsy, lacking in necessarily changes, and lacking in that word that I'd like to play with a little bit today, lacking in spontaneity. The system does not require, nor does it want, any spontaneity. It wants it to be consistent, working for everyone who comes, whether the offering by the very well-off could be a bull, or for those less well-off, a fistful of grain. Whatever offering it was a system that was open to everyone. And I think that's really an important thing to understand of why, perhaps, Nadav and Avihu's self-motivated offering was seen, if you think about it in computer terms, that these two were hackers going into the system and hacking it and creating something that would take it off its initial, if you will, goal, which was basically this openness of system for everyone. So it's really a very difficult thing to understand. And one of the things that I like to talk about in doing this is that the Korbanot system, which everybody sort of, you know, has problems with, oh, you're offering animals, but you're also offering wheat, you're offering, it's very common if you go to many temples in India and elsewhere to see people bringing something. It's the idea of bringing something to something, something larger than themselves, just making a small sense of their own contribution to things, is very, 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 very important to people and also very sustaining to people. And this is what I think Nadav and Avihu basically were not entirely sure. Does the structure work? If the structure doesn't work, maybe it needs a tweak, and the tweak they're going to give is their own selves. Now that leads me to think about what does it mean? What does it mean to be in the presence of the divine and avoid being absorbed totally into it? Many traditions have the idea of the self-annihilation upon connection to the divine. That if you get too close to the holy will absorb you. And remember, there's a tension in the holy. A wonderful book I always mention that you should take a look at is by Rudolf Otto, beginning of the last century, called The Idea of the Holy. And the holy basically is attractive. It wants to take you in. It wants to make you at one with. And yet, at the same time, there is this forward movement and there is also this retreat. In the Kabbalistic language, it's called Retzov Veshov. You're going towards and then you return. And what are you returning to? You're retreating back into life. You're retreating back into life. Ultimately, this is the tension. We want to live. We love life. There's something to about loving life that really enriches us, of course, that gives us room to take our talents, to take, even though we seek a reduction of our ego, we hope that by coming back into life and using our practice that we use, we can at least channel our egos to more honorable goals. So this is the challenge that we have in spirituality, quote unquote, whatever that word really, really means. But what does it mean to offer strange fire? That's a strange term. Azar, how is fire strange? I think it should be best in understood not as strange fire, but as spontaneous fire, the spontaneity. Now remember, the opening ceremony has God himself come down and take up the offering, and thus showing that there is a right association, a connection between heaven and earth, between the Israelites and God. And then there's also this idea that now a fire will come from above and take two sons of Aaron, in a sense, as sacrifices. It's very, very, very stunning, right? Since we, of course, abjure human sacrifice in our tradition. So it's really a challenge. It's really a challenge to see how to understand this. Were they indeed, as many of the commentators say, transgressing something, and they were punished? And you have lists of things that they could have done. The most noticeable one is, they say, following this in the text, a priest should not drink wine before going and doing the service. So were they intoxicated? Were they punished for all kinds of other things, undermining the authority of their elders, etc., etc.? The tradition, for the most part, sees them as being culpable of something that deserved the punishment of death. There are, however, a few others who see no. They see that basically what Nadab and Avihu had was that they basically were zealous. That's a term that's used, zealotry. And zealotry, of course, has very positive and very negative, if you will, connotations, particularly today as we look out into the world to see so much zealotry, which goes above and beyond what we would expect. So if this indeed was this sense of their desire, now that the system was working, to offer themselves up to the system, in a way, they were fulfilling, if you will, their own desire, if you will, to leave this existence and to become part of the larger, if you will, revelation of God in the world. They wanted to leave life. Matter of fact, one of the castigators of Nadav and Avihu says that one of the things they're being punished for is because they did not get married and they didn't have children. Now, that's very important in a dynastic tradition like the priesthood, where it's all based upon having having children. And maybe that's why they were eager to offer themselves up and knew that in their offering themselves, they would not be returning to life, and thus there was no reason to have children. However you interpret this, it's quite mysterious, and there's nobody who's ever satisfied and come up with an answer. But one thing we can say is that we have the capacity to lose ourselves in our quote-unquote spiritual lives. We have a tendency, we have to be careful about that, we elevate our spiritual lives beyond our everyday life rather than seeing one is supplementing the other. And I think this is always a challenge for all of us. We want to leave this world as it is, hoping to find some sense of salvation, maybe swallow it up into the greater good. And maybe that's what happens after we leave our earthly plane. I'm not sure. No one's given me any real guidance to that. But we have this capacity to say, I want to leave this world and everything behind it because of the struggle it entails. And yet, the other side of the coin is, because of my connection to my spiritual life, I feel I can be in this world. I can be introspective. I can be active in it. I can, however, also be carefully aware of the fact that I can be drawn in to doing all kinds of negative things in the world as well. So here we have Nadav and Avihu, the examples, if you will, of self-sacrifice, if I can use that term. Not everybody sees it this way. I mean, I see it as a way that they desire, in a way, to be in that, in the aura, if you will, of God forever, and thus gave themselves up. But it remains a mystery, and I'm not sure we'll ever solve it, of course, but it does give us a lot of food for thought. What is it about ourselves that we wish to give up, sell, sacrifice? What are we willing to give up, really, to sacrifice in order to be, quote-unquote, in a spiritual space? And should we give these things up? Should we give these things up? Now, one of the ways we dealt with it when we retreated back into the world, as most of us do and most of our mystics do, they always come back into the world. There are a few examples in the Talmud, of course, of the famous four who entered into paradise, and one does not come back because he gets absorbed totally within this cosmic kind of center. But we did something much more powerful, and that was we came back into the world. We come back into the world every day if we awaken, and we basically say, how can we understand our attraction to the divine? By making everything in the world divine, creating a new way of looking at the world. Looking at the world by seeing the divine in all things. So one doesn't have to leave the world in order to be attached to the divine. One has to be actively in the world. And this, as Reb Zalman used to call it, the divinization, the creating the divinity of the world. It's a sort of pantheism, there's no question about it. But it really does give us an answer of how we, as Jews and people of all traditions, of people of good faith in all of these traditions, have said the best way to connect with the divine is not being absorbed by it, to be annihilated within it, to be self-abnegated. Some Eastern religions do talk about the that one loses oneself, one in a sense even kills oneself when one becomes attached to the divine. But we believe, no, we stay in this world and we do the best we can. But more importantly, we understand the attraction. And it's an interesting thing, you know, as I say, Rudolf Otto in his book says, you know, but the holy is very, attracts as well as repels. So there's attraction and repulsion. There's ritzov v'shov, there's forward and back. There's a charge ahead, and then there's a retreat back. And that tension of back and forth and back and forth is a healthy one. And in general, you know, over the years I've mentioned that tension is not a terrible thing. We always try to have hypertension. Is not great. I take pills for that. But tension in itself is not a bad thing. It gives us the ability to stretch ourselves a bit too, create a tension. The example that's often used is that if you don't make a tension on strings on a guitar or a violin, etc., you won't be able to play it. No sound will emerge. It comes out of stretching ourselves. It comes out of our tension. So I know I led to more mystery because the talk is mysterious as well. Where it comes from is also mysterious. But I hope that we have a chance to talk a little bit now about how this we deal with this fact of the attraction of sort of wanting to leave this existence and the fact that we have a capacity to be within it and in a very positive way. So let's open it up a little bit. Yes, I see some hands. Okay, let me open. Okay, Beryl, please.